Sign of life there. Sign of life.
Hello, Lynn.
How do you do?
Good. So we got these guys are up here already.
They are.
The boxes, the tapes are running.
Where are they?
They're there.
They're in California, huh?
They should be able to hear you.
I don't know.
Okay.
Maybe Marty hasn't turned me up yet, but I told him it'd be about 5 till. What you're hearing is them and me.
Hello, George?
Yes, sir.
Okay, we're here.
Lynn's here, too.
Oh, Lynn, you ready to go?
Sure, I'm ready to go.
All right, we're up here in Fraser Park, up in the mountains. And
again, huh?
Yeah, we go to the mountains quite often. In this kind of heat, it's a good place to go.
Yeah, you had enough lifting experience then recently.
Yes. So we're all set. Go ahead, Lynn.
Okay, good. For today's occasion, let's start with something which is you can refer to because it's in the briefing now, and it will be published this weekend on this issue on the case of the vice president's mass insanity. I put a good deal into this in a fairly hasty way over the past couple of weeks. But there's one thing in there which pertains particularly to your deployments and activities concerning me, which is in there, which is of rather crucial importance, and I'd like to focus on that right now because it strikes something which I'm sure many of you have not even thought that much about. Though you've run into the charges against me that I was convicted of this or that or so forth. And actually, if you know the story, it has absolutely the opposite, directly opposite implications to what you might hear on the street from some nagging characters. The reason I was sent to prison was that on March the 23rd of 1983, President Ronald Reagan announced and proposed publicly on a internationally relayed U.S. television broadcast in a five-minute segment at the conclusion of that talk to the nation. He proposed to the Soviet government explicitly and to the people of the United States and others that we should proceed to get out of the age of thermonuclear revenge weapons and go instead to what he called a strategic defense initiative. Now, there are two aspects to what the president did then, and it's the consequences of what he did and what I had done in that connection, which produced a wave of hatred against me from both the leadership of the Democratic Party and Republican Party, many inside the Reagan administration itself, and from the Soviet government, especially from Andropov, who was then the General Secretary of the Soviet Union Party, and then later from Gorbachev, Mikhail Gorbachev, who himself, with his wife Raisa, who's now dead, publicly, repeatedly, and violently asked essentially that I either be assassinated or imprisoned. And that attitude expressed by the Soviet government of Gorbachev was shared by the leadership of the Democratic Party and by many in the Republican Party, including the circles around Vice President George H.W. Bush, the father of the incumbent president. Now, the issue is the following. Let me take Reagan's side first of all. Now, Reagan was, in a sense, like me. He was a veteran of World War II period and experience, which means he was also a veteran of Franklin Roosevelt's presidency. And while he turned in Hollywood to a right-wing posture under the influence of the Truman administration and later, and became known as a right-winger on that issue, a part of the anti-Soviet right-wing mobilization, which was launched in the wake of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that he, at the same time, through most of his political life later on, as new weapons came up. And then finally, of course, in the course of the late 1950s and more into the 1960s, there was the adoption of a policy that we would use a mass development of rockets, nuclear ballistic missile rockets, armed with thermonuclear warheads and then multiple thermonuclear warheads as a weapon so terrible that nobody would dare to go to war, which was not nonsense because the danger of going to war was increasing, actually, more or less all of this period. So Reagan developed a deeply impassioned hatred of Henry A. Kissinger because he saw Kissinger in the Nixon administration, when Nixon became Secretary of State, saw Kissinger as the embodiment of Satan, which is not an unfair judgment, but it was his judgment. And what he said, he was always along, he hated this idea that our defense should be dependent upon what he called revenge weapons. That is, if they throw a nuclear missile, we throw one. If we throw one, they throw the works and we throw the works, which means the virtual extermination of both sides and a lot of the rest of the world aside. So he hated Henry Kissinger, and he hated revenge weapons and the policy that Kissinger represented overall. Now, 1977, I began to, because I was concerned with this particular problem, myself in my own way, and in my capacity in part as a leading figure of the Fusion Energy Foundation, mobilized the resources accessible to us, scientific and other resources, within and outside the FEF, to work on the fact that we knew that it were possible to develop systems which could actually intercept and defeat a barrage of thermonuclear weapons, ballistic missile weapons. Not that we could prevent them all, but we could prevent enough to prevent any launch of missiles from being strategically decisive, that is, to end in hell. And the very fact that we were able to do that, if both sides would agree, the Soviet Union and we, if we would agree to develop these kinds of weapon systems, and the Soviets had a technological potential for doing that too, as well as we did, if we cooperated in that purpose, and we're operating on a policy of preparing to reach that state of affairs, of a mutual defense against thermonuclear ballistic attack, then we wouldn't have an attack. The problem was we were already on a hair trigger. Now, what got me on this concern was something that happened during the course of a 1976 campaign for the presidency where I was running as an independent for the presidential nomination election. And during this period, I came across letters, correspondence, emanating from the circles of Zbigniew Brzezinski and the revival of an organization called the Committee for the Present Danger, which was at that point headed by Brzezinski's crowd. And this correspondence indicated they were moving for an actual provocation of a nuclear war. So in the course of this campaign, the last phase of the election campaign of 1976, put this on a 5-minute national NBC broadcast as a campaign broadcast featuring the danger of a nuclear war coming out of the Carter candidacy, that is the Trilateral Commission Brzezinski candidacy, and then repeated that within the larger framework of a half-hour national TV broadcast, NBC this time, on the NBC network, on election eve. This killed my exposure to this, killed that plan, which had been the basic strategic plan of Brzezinski and company for the Carter administration. That they had other plans, but this was the military plan. So therefore, in 1977, the election vie, what I had done bestirred some approaches to us and discussion with us from circles who were in, shall we say, in the know, and indicated their interest in the fact that there had been a discussion about this kind of issue of a strategic, non-strategic defense, a science-based strategic defense against thermonuclear missile attacks. So I got onto it, pulled together resources we had, did some studies, I had some studies done in part, which indicated to me that we knew exactly how we could approach this question from a scientific standpoint, of developing an alternative to this mutual assured destruction of thermonuclear ballistic missile exchanges. I featured that in 1979 in my own election campaign for the Democratic nomination for presidency. I did that in the summer of 1979. Then, because I had played a key part, not specifically intentionally, but because George Bush got into a catfight with me by attacking me in New Hampshire, and I responded. And, you know, George H.W. Bush is not very bright, really. He's not a psychotic like his son, but he's not very bright. The idea of calling the CIA headquarters the George H.W. Bush Center for Intelligence is the biggest oxymoron I've heard in recent years. But so he reacted, his crew reacted stupidly. And they went after me, and I went after them, and I exposed what they were doing. I exposed the Trilateral Commission operation, and I exposed his background and his little special club that he, Harriman, had brought him into. So he went wild. His crew went wild. Now, in the middle of this, I met Reagan as a candidate, where we were seated together in a candidate's night in what a place that no longer exists, what was then the New Hampshire Highway Hotel in Concord, New Hampshire. And we were off in a corner, so we were chatting together while this proceedings was going on, a couple thousand people there in this candidate's night. We got acquainted. We were already sort of acquainted anyway. But then, as a result of George Bush going wild, he really flubbed it against Reagan in a Manchester, New Hampshire candidates debate on the Republican side. And then he really blew it in Concord, New Hampshire, in where Reagan made this famous thing, holding up this microphone. I paid for this microphone. And as a result of that, Reagan took the New Hampshire nomination, more or less like a landslide, and went on to take the presidency, the Republican nomination and the presidency. Now, at the time that Reagan was elected, naturally there was a reflection back to me from Richard Richards, who was then heading the Republican Party organization. And I went down to Washington to meet with representatives of the incoming Reagan administration in the late 1980. And I met a number of people, and what I did is put forth my wish list of what the United States government should do under a Reagan presidency. Now, much of this was not accepted. There was interest in a lot of things on my list, but much of it was not accepted. But there some was. And one of the things that struck interest was through a series of developments that I had proposed that the policy of the United States be the proposal to the Soviet Union of and others of a shared development, scientific development, of an existing potential for developing weapon systems which could defeat the strategic purpose of a general thermonuclear ballistic missile attack. This attracted interest. As a result of this and some related things, I developed a relationship with the Reagan administration in which they accepted the idea of my conducting a back-channel discussion with the Soviet government, then of, well, Andropov came in during that period later, to explore the possibility of such cooperation among the United States and Soviet Union and other countries. In the meantime, we organized in Germany and France, in Italy and elsewhere, and in the United States, we organized a very large constituency which is largely based on traditional leading military thinkers, retired and others, in the governments or in the retired services of these military organizations. So we had quite a constituency going for the idea of using an alternative to general thermonuclear missile exchange. During this period, I always had these rather regular chats with the Soviet representative, the representative of the Soviet government, who was meeting with me for exchange on the discussion of the possibility that both the President of the United States and the Soviet government would come to an agreement on exploring and developing this alternative to mutual and assured destruction. I had a meeting in February, as I reported in this recent paper. Again, I've reported it several places. But what I reported there recently is of special significance. I had a feedback from the Soviet government in February of 1983. And the report was then a presentation of the fact the Soviet government would agree that I was right, that it was technologically feasible, that both the United States and the Soviet government could do this, but they wouldn't. They wouldn't do it in a cooperation with the United States. That instead they would develop their own capability, and I knew something about what that was, and they would beat us in a technological race to be ahead of us in terms of this kind of nuclear missile defense. So I said to my interlocutor then, I said, well, you guys are crazy. You don't realize that if you take this course of action, that within approximately 5 years, the Soviet system would collapse economically, for economic reasons, of the strain of trying to do this under your present economic policies. And that was that. We kept the door open for further discussion. Now, I said, if the president, what I put it this way, if the president of the United States proffers to your government publicly what I have outlined to you as my design for this policy, and if your government then rejects this, as you have indicated they are inclined to do, then I can assure you that the Soviet Union will collapse for economic reasons within about 5 years. This is February 1983. So I was off about a year. But it happened. Now, the president then went on March 23rd, 1983, went on national television, actually international, to make, in a five-minute segment, to make an offer which was precisely the formulation which I had used, with one adjustment by him, but precisely the substantive offer which I had proposed, which I had in my discussions with the Soviet government. Andropov summarily rejected it, and refused on repeated attempts to reopen the discussion. That is, the Soviet government absolutely refused to even discuss this thing with the President of the United States when the President of the United States had offered it. And that the result of that was essentially the collapse of the Soviet Union, beginning with the disintegration of the Warsaw Pact organization in 1989. Now, this is March 23rd, 1983, when the president made this television address. Immediately, within a week or two, when it was clear that Andropov had summarily rejected this proposal, most of the Republican administration, not the president himself, but most of them in there, who had gone along with this only because the president was pushing it. But when Andropov turned it down, they went wild. Their intention was to get rid of me for two reasons. First of all, because I had done this. And secondly, because in my success in doing this over their resistance and over their policy meant that I personally represented a strategic political capability as a leading international figure, which was more than they wanted to handle. So therefore, from that point on, with a campaign to eliminate me, which was started within days, no later than days or a couple of weeks, after the president's address, it was a continual effort and a debate in those circles to either to kill me or to imprison me, defame me, that methods, and get me out of business one way or the other. Many people said, no, killing is the preferred objective. That included the Soviet government. The Soviet government publicly and repeatedly demanded that I be eliminated and said, essentially, by killing him or other means, imprisoning him or other means. And they went to that. That's what they were committed to. So from that point on, through beyond 1989, the policy of a dominant circles around then Vice President and later President George H.W. Bush, from the Soviet government of Gorbachev, from the leadership of the Democratic Party, from the secret intelligence apparatus which is deeply embedded in the Department of Justice, and from those circles, there was a determination of either kill him or imprison him. If he beats these fake charges we're cooking up against him, kill him. And a lot of people who admired me and so forth in our institution said, well, we don't want him killed. If he can't beat the charges and this frame-up that's coming up against him, let him go to prison and we'll get him out later. And that's what happened. So, in effect, George H.W. Bush put me in the jug and Bill Clinton got me out. Now, everything about me, internationally as well as in the United States, in the political party apparatuses and so forth, is all determined to the present day by this policy. This policy on me is the most sensitive issue inside the political infrastructure of the United States and other countries. And that's what you're up against in the street. And that's what I summarily report upon within the context of part of this paper on this subject of the Vice President's mass insanity. When you are organizing or dealing with me on the streets, what you run into, whether in political party circles or other circles, is either a direct reflection of people who are on the inside of this operation or reflections of the inside of this operation, or people who are affected by the spillover of this thing from spring 1983 until really 1994. In this whole period, this was a central feature and a not secret feature of U.S. policy and the policies of governments in Europe, including the Mitterrand government in France and others. So that's what you're up against. Now, if you look at the thing, what this does, and it's to your advantage to use it, and it belongs to you more than it does to me, because you're going to be living for two or three more generations if the world doesn't go crazy, and I'm not. So therefore, you're going to have to live with this as my legacy, or part of my legacy. What you're running up against is people said, didn't he go to jail? Yeah, because he's a national folk hero. What was wrong with you? Did you support him? That's your response. That's what you're up against. And you have to understand that. But that has an implication which I want to address right now. And then I want to let you get back at me after having said these things. What I represent is a guy who, coming out of World War II, came back to the United States after return from overseas service to find a country which had changed from a nation led by Franklin Roosevelt and his policies, with opposition to him within the institutions and from England, from Churchill and company, to a United States under Truman, which had, for the purpose of destroying everything that Roosevelt represented, piecemeal, starting with the general international policy, that a Churchill-Truman effect alliance against Franklin Roosevelt and everything he represented was in charge. And a right-wing crowd, which Eisenhower later referred to in the close of his presidency as the military-industrial complex, the fascist, pro-fascist right wing, took over. I mean, the pro-fascist right wing was composed of bankers, including Prescott Bush, the grandfather of the present president, who had been the guy who, from the U.S. side, led in moving the money, which they controlled inside Germany, into the party coffers of the Nazi Party. At the time, the Nazi Party was bankrupt, to get it out of bankruptcy in time to have Hitler appointed, first of all, as chancellor, and then with the help of Goering setting fire to the Reichstag, of becoming a dictator, which meant, of course, World War II. So these guys, because they learned that later that the Hitler they had supported had cut a deal with the Soviet government under which the Hitler would attack westward first instead of eastward, as people like Prescott Bush had intended, that under these conditions, where Roosevelt's dead and Hitler is out dead, these guys move back the same kind of long-term strategic policy, an Anglo-Dutch liberal policy, which became known as the Cold War. I came back, and I found that among people who had been in military service and their same circles, who had been defenders and enthusiasts for Roosevelt and his policy, increasingly during the period of the 1930s, and especially during the period of the war, many of these people, out of sheer cowardice, I would say about 90% of them, were turned within the course of the Truman administration into right-wing fascist fanatics in terms of their outlook on the world. Not because they were fascists themselves, but because they wanted to get along. If you want to get by, if you want to have a job, if you want to have secure, if you don't want to be harassed by the FBI, be a fascist. Now, these people weren't fascists, but they had to pretend to be fascists, and many of them became fascists. And that's what I've lived through. As a result of this process, and a result of the brainwashing of your parents' generation, while they, you know, the people who were born in the immediate post-war period or about that time, who were educated under the influence of the Congress for Cultural Freedom during the 1950s and so forth, the so-called baby boomer generation, were corrupted and virtually destroyed. In the time that I was in prison or being persecuted, for between 1983 and approximately 1994, during that period, power passed in the United States from my generation to the baby boomer generation. That is, the people who were running the government, running institutions in the 1980s, began to go out of positions of leadership through retirement or attrition. Whereas the baby boomer generation began to put its people into all the top positions in all the industries. And that's what the change has been. So as a result of that, there are, in leading positions, with the exception of some people, as you'll find in the Senate and some people in the Congress, or people like that in other institutions, retired or otherwise, who represent, in a sense, the same kind of thinking or something like it, which I represented, you find that the majority of the baby boomer generation has two problems. First of all, there's very little leadership among them. That doesn't mean they're all bad people. It means they are so confused, so their brains are turned into a kind of porridge. They cannot think clearly and effectively. They're now sitting, looking at a rocking chair or the equivalent as baby boomers and hoping that when death comes, they won't know it happened or won't know what's happening. They have no sense of a future. They have only a sense of doing our thing while we're still alive. Some of them are rich, most aren't. They're not corrupted by money as such. They're corrupted by a retreat into what's called a lifestyle. It may be a poor lifestyle. It means going to certain meetings, meeting certain friends, doing certain things, wearing certain things, being seen doing this. Things like wearing old socks that never get washed, and you keep wearing them because they seem comfortable and familiar to you, whereas the new ones are strangers you don't want to mess with. Yeah? That is this lifestyle idiocy, which is as much in Europe, especially in Western Europe, as it is in the United States. That is the problem of the baby boomer generation, which in France is called the bobos, the bohème bourgeois, or bourgeois bohème, bobos, which has another connotation in Spanish slang. These are the bobos. And therefore, as a result of that, the characteristics of leadership of effective leadership, strategic leadership, have fallen to a large degree upon me as is almost an accident. You say, who understands this world? Who understands how to fix this? And I'm stuck in the position, not that I regret it or anything, but I'm stuck in the position, which I do regret, that the leadership required to get the United States and the world out of the present mess falls upon a few people, very few people. And I am the one person in the position with a personal record, as I just indicated on the question of SDI and its implications, who is qualified to lead this nation. Now, at this point, I'm not running for president and have no intention of doing so right now. Under certain conditions, I would accept the job if if I were needed. But what I'm trying to do now is to use my knowledge and my understanding of things that very few other people do understand, in order to get this nation to take the actions which are needed to save the world from hell. We're headed into a general breakdown crisis of civilization. No part of the world would survive a collapse of the United States at this time. There's no other part of the world which has a plan or a capability for maintaining the continued existence of civilized life on this planet for generations to come if the United States goes down. And therefore, my role in the United States in building from here into other parts of the world a motion which can save this planet from hell in the immediate weeks and months ahead. That's my job. And in a sense, that's your job. It's your job for two reasons. First of all, I'm not going to be around for that much longer. I won't be around for another full generation. I'd be around for 10 years or so. I'm a rather relatively good condition, especially very good condition for my age. And I'll be around and functioning probably for about a decade more. But you face the responsibility for the coming two generations of saving this planet. You are typical of the people who must qualify themselves to lead this planet for the next 20 odd years or more. You, probably two generations, when you take the places which are occupied by the baby boomers today. And therefore, it's important to you and important to humanity as a whole that you, whether in Europe or elsewhere, but especially in the United States, that you understand what I have just said and its implications. I am now at the center of the possibility of the survival of civilized life on this planet. Not because I'm that good, but because the rest fall that far short. I have a handful of people on this planet, relatively speaking, who are of my generation or baby boomer generation, who are still in action, who are capable of pulling together governments which are capable of doing the job to which I'm committed. But beyond that, there's not much. You represent the future of humanity. You represent the future of humanity for two generations to come. You are not in the top positions yet. You are going to qualify yourself rapidly, as many are, and I've watched this over the past, half decade, as the youth movement has emerged. In the half decade, those who've come into it have produced an inner group, which are the equivalent of university graduates, have gone through our university, so to speak, who are actually becoming leading thinkers, becoming a generation of young people of your generation, which is more qualified, potentially, than the generations in power. But you're not yet in power. You're still a young generation who are influencing power and must continue to influence power and must continue to develop. But your development requires two things. First of all, what you must become. And the first thing you have to concentrate on is what you must become, what role you must play for the coming two generations, as a generation, for the coming two generations, the coming 50 years of this planet. You must qualify yourself to become the leadership of this planet during the coming 50 years. You must, in the meantime, now, at the same time, take your development in two ways. First, as you develop, you are the most effective force as a generation, or people from your generation, the most effective force in influencing those institutions in power. You are effective because you are better than those who are not with us in general, and you're effective because they see you as the future. When people your age group come in to the Congress or to other institutions, intelligent people who can think recognize you as the next generation, the coming generation. You are the ones who make me a threat for two generations to come. And intelligent people recognize that. So therefore, you are doing a job now at your age level, at your level of influence. And you are preparing yourself to become the leadership of the United States and other nations in the course of the coming generations, two generations. And if you understand where you came from, in part, as you came from my experience, or the things I experienced, and in part, you come from the what happened to me between March of 1983 up to the present time, but especially 1983 into 1984, after Bush had put me into prison and Clinton got me out. Okay, that's it.
Kaylin, you'll take some questions?
Yeah, they're not too
right.
Questionable.
So let's line up for questions. We'll start, Tim?
You can turn it down a little bit. It's a little loud there.
Okay.
Or you can turn it down here. George can do it.
I got it.
Hello, Lynn?
Yes.
Hi there. This is Timothy from Los Angeles. I really enjoyed your discussion in Berlin at the end of June. I'm sure you did too. So I had a question regarding the coming establishment of a new Bretton Woods agreement and how we would go about exchange rates, because you made it very clear about the necessity of determining a currency's value based on production, productivity of not just a small elite portion of your society, but the productivity of an entire nation, of an entire people. And it rings loud and clear in my mind, but how would you quantize that? How, other than, well, I guess I'm looking for a unit, because I understand how you could compare individual nations' relative production or productive capability relative to each other, but what would be your starting unit? Would we pick a time period of, say, humanity's greatest productivity, say, the United States economy at the end of World War II, and that's our unit, and then judge values relative to that? Or, yeah, how would you quantize that?
Okay.
And but there's one more part of the question, which is, once we do that, if we set each of the nation's currencies to that, wouldn't we put poor, undeveloped nations, wouldn't we burden them with low currency values and robbing them of purchasing power to import high-intensity technological capital goods?
Mm-hmm.
Or how would you go about that?
All right. First of all, you make one mistake in your formulation of the question. You say, what on basis of past up to now would we use as a standard of measure in international markets? Well, first of all, whereas most people today would say we go by past performance as such, and we try to find a level of currencies in terms of the dollar and so forth for the future from the past, as I've emphasized, and as you recall in Berlin, that as I've emphasized, is you don't use a dollar defined the way the dollar is defined in most university and popular babble today. I said, what do? The United States government must intervene by declaring a fixing of things at the present level. That, and how does it do that? It does that by saying our policy is for the next 50 years on this planet, the U.S. dollar is going to continue. It's going to be guaranteed at approximately its present level relative to other currencies for 50 years to come. Now, how is that going to work? What that means is we do a reorganization, a bankruptcy reorganization of the U.S. system in particular, and also with the cooperation of other countries, the present IMF system. We freeze dollar relations at their present level for a long period to come. Essentially, we're looking at 50 years to come, two generations. Now, you at present, if you try to deal with the current state of currency obligations and so forth, the world would plunge very soon into a prolonged new dark age in which all currencies, present currencies, would vanish, and with them most nations and entire language groups of people, as well as a reduction of the world population to something like below 1 billion people from the present level of over six. And this would occur within a period of about two generations. Would be an unstoppable general breakdown crisis. So we step in. We say there's no way that the world can survive under present world conditions if the dollar suddenly goes into a 30 to 40% plunge in value in the international markets, which it can do at any time right now. But if the United States government says, we are now prepared to guarantee the value of the dollar by forcing, through bankruptcy reorganization, by taking current U.S. obligations respecting the dollar and freezing their value at the present level approximately for 50 years to come. We don't have to say 50 years immediately, but that's what we're going to have to do. How will we do that? We will do that by putting the whole system into bankruptcy. That is, all central banking systems of the world will go into bankruptcy, either willfully or otherwise. That is, if countries do not agree to join the United States in the general bankruptcy reorganization of the IMF, then they will become history. The governments will become history. If they agree, then we will be putting the IMF into bankruptcy, into receivership. And by the concert of governments who, out of not because they are really willing or desirous of doing this, but because they know they have no choice, will join with the United States in a mutual self-defense of their future and the future of their people and nations by saying, we agree, we're going to freeze this, all these systems in bankruptcy reorganization over a period as long as two generations to come. Now, what does that mean? That means that around the world, we will, first of all, put most of these claims into receivership. All financial derivatives, which is the biggest part of the debt, will be automatically canceled either by the will of governments or canceled despite the will of governments. In other words, if they willfully agree to us, to what we propose, then they will willfully and cheerfully cancel all obligations denominated as part of financial derivatives. Cancel them. That eliminates the greatest danger. It also means that we're going to put a lot of things in bankruptcy. We're going to have to put the entire real estate system of the United States and United Kingdom in particular into receivership. There's no way that these mortgage values can be maintained in general. Take the California in general. There's no way you can defend the mortgages at the present estimated value. There's no way in Loudoun County, Virginia, that you can defend the price of houses presently. The houses that are now listed at between $750,000, or shacks, actually, many of them, to $1 million or more, these things are going to go down to less than $100,000. Maybe not all at once, but they're headed in that direction because they're not worth it. What does that mean? You're going to wipe out 80 to 90% probably of the assessed mortgage value of these properties. What are you going to do? You're going to have to do it. You can't put people on the streets. You cannot evict people from all these houses because they can't possibly pay the rents, can't possibly pay the mortgages. You've got to keep them in the houses they live in. At least it gives them the right to stay there. and you're going to have to protect them. But you're going to have to write down mortgages which are listed at, you know, three-quarters of a million to a million and a half. You're going to have to write those down into much lower two-digit or $50,000 level. Which means the system, the mortgage system and the banking system, the mortgage-based security systems is going to collapse, take a big blow. How do you handle that? Well, you put the banks in receivership. You begin to freeze things. You convert certain short-term obligations into long-term obligations, that kind of stuff. The basis of this, however, is not simply writing down and reorganizing on the basis of the current level of flows. You want to keep everybody presently employed, generally. You want, and so forth. But that's not going to work. You have to do that. But that doesn't give you a future. We get a future by putting the central banking systems of the world, including the quasi-central banking system, our Federal Reserve System, into receivership, into bankruptcy reorganization. This is done by governments. The IMF is reorganized by governments, which put the respective banking systems, central banking systems of the world, into receivership, in bankruptcy. And you freeze everything and manage everything in bankruptcy reorganization. Now, we've got to get some activity going. The world in general, especially in the United States and Europe, is operating below break-even. The economies of Europe are operating currently below break-even. That is, they are producing less and earning less as nations than is required to maintain the existing nation with its employment, its consumption, and so forth, at the present level. You can't do it. Therefore, you're going to have to put everything into bankruptcy receivership. You're going to eliminate the institution of the independent central banking system will be eliminated from the face of the planet, either willingly or otherwise. Is going to disappear. The entire Venetian system, which is represented by so-called independent central banking systems and represented by the corruption of our system by the present form of the Federal Reserve System, is going to have to be put into bankruptcy receivership by the respective governments. We're going to go to national banking. In other words, all these central banking systems and similar systems we put into receivership by governments and with the cooperation among most governments. And we go to national banking in which the United States principle, the Hamiltonian principle as it's sometimes called, of national banking, will rule. There will be no banking, no value, except that which is run in conjunction with a national banking system of the United States and the national banking system of the other countries. In our case, it will simply be returning to our Constitution with the prescription as amply defined by Hamilton of national banking. A national bank will be created and the Federal Reserve assets and so forth will be tumbled into control by this national banking institution, which is to restore us back to a constitutional system of banking. We will have a lot of private banks, but they will be coordinated either directly, that is national banks, coordinated by the U.S. National Bank, or will be state banks, state-chartered banks, which operate through the states, but are also as part of the general system. Similar things will be done in other countries. Now, the purpose here is we freeze payments on a lot of things. We don't pay them. That's what often happens in bankruptcy. So we just don't pay a lot of things. But we set a bunch of priorities. We want people working. We want them paid. We want pensions paid. This sort of thing. So we agreed that's our priorities. Now what do? We go to the power of the state to create currency to do two things. Or actually three things. What we do is the state takes responsibility for creating a new credit system. Where state obligations, long-term debt of governments, national governments, become the source of the income, the capital, the financial capital, for expanding production and employment, or replacing employment which shouldn't exist. A lot of these real estate brokers will have to go out of work, their present work, and have to go into honest, making an honest living. We'll have to provide those jobs. We'll provide those jobs by long-term projects, chiefly. Long-term investment in building infrastructure and promoting industrial and agricultural expansion, rebuilding the economies, the physical economies. We will then take everything was done under Brzezinski during the Carter administration, and everything was done under Nixon before that. We will cancel it. We will go back to the standard of regulated economy, which is traditional for the United States, especially by intention originally, and since Lincoln, and also since Roosevelt. We'll go back to the Roosevelt system, in which 50% of the total economy of the United States will be in the public sector. The public sector, even in the sense of government operations by federal, state, and local institutions, or by chartered operations such as public utilities, which are objects of private investment but operate within a protected, regulated environment, such as mass transportation systems, all these kinds of things, which are really public works, water systems. So the federal government will be the driver behind the activities by state governments and local governments of expanding infrastructure. What we will do is we will put everything under regulation. We will go away from a free trade determination of pricing into a fair trade system of pricing of the type, for example, we had in the 1950s. We go back to a fair trade policy on investment and price. We were going to have higher tax rates on the upper brackets of income in particular, because we have to have guarantees that these debts, new debts we're creating, are going to be paid. And that's going to mean taxes. And the government is going to have to establish the taxes and collect the taxes in order to have this marginal amount of current payment on account on the amount of debts we're going to create. We're going to create a massive amount of new debt. We are going to mix, we're going to reorganize the old debt. So debt that is, say, 2-year, 3-year, 5-year, 10-year maturities will be reorganized so it'll have up to 10 to 20 years maturities, 25 years maturities, and so forth. Maturities which correspond more closely to the actual physical lifetime, life expectancy of the type of investment involved. All right, now, so therefore, the way in which prices are determined is now under a regulated system, under not the capitalist system, but the American system as the Constitution defines it. And as our experience with it, say under Lincoln, for example, where we became, from a second-rate country, we became the leading country in the world virtually, very quickly, under Lincoln, between 1863 in particular and 1876, the time of the Philadelphia Centennial Celebration. We became the leading nation of the world in economic performance. Germany, under Bismarck, copied our industrial system, introduced a social welfare system in Germany, which is being canceled now, but which existed until the present time, under Bismarck, directly copied from the United States under the influence of the leading economists of the United States and the world, Henry C. Carey. Japan reorganized its system on that basis. France, once rid of Napoleon III, began to move in directions based on the American experience. Italy became a nation and was oriented in the direction of this reform, the United States. In Russia, Tsar Alexander II accepted on the recommendation of the great scientist Mendeleev, going to the American system of industrial development, which resulted in Mendeleev's leadership in organizing the Trans-Siberian Railroad and so forth, and industry. So the American system is the system which must run the world, not as an empire of the United States, but as a system shared with the rest of the world. Now, prices are now going to be determined on that basis. What we will have, we'll have two levels of kinds of currencies. As Helga is dealing with this problem in Germany. Germany, by a terrible mistake, adopted the euro in replacement of the Deutschmark. And we cannot get rid of the euro overnight. But what we can do, as Helga has indicated, you can convert the euro into a currency of account, which is used by governments to settle accounts between nations, but not is not an account something that's on the street, sold on the street, or traded on the street. Germany would go back to the euro, Italy would go back to the lira, France would go back to the franc, and so forth, and you would have, the euro would be functioning in a way like the ECU arrangement, which was set up among people like Giscard d'Estaing and Schmidt and so forth back in the 1970s. So that kind of operation. So therefore, we're not talking about how we adjust for the past, we're talking about how we transform from a past-oriented economy to a future-oriented economy. Today, everything is cash on the barrel. Everything is on current account. There is no capital. Capital is almost outlawed. You can't make capital anymore. You cannot issue financial capital anymore. You cannot expand. You have to eat your legs if you want meat. So therefore, we're changing the psychology and the outlook of the world to what? To the American system as Abraham Lincoln implemented it, as Franklin Roosevelt implemented it, as we should never have departed from it. And as European countries and others accepted the idea of the American system as typified by Roosevelt in the post-war reconstruction in Europe and in other parts of the world, as it was accepted more and more in parts of South and Central America prior to Nixon. Right? So what we will be doing, therefore, since the capital investment we will be making, especially in major infrastructure and in industrial development and in agricultural development, for example, developing a crop on an existing developed farm may take us maybe a three-year capital cycle. Developing a power plant is at least a quarter century. Developing a water system in general, a major water system or a major power network, is a 50-year investment. So therefore, what we will be doing is we will be taking debt, and we will have debt defined such the time of repayment of a capital investment, that is the liquidation of a capital investment, will be less than the physical lifetime of that investment. So therefore, we will not be talking about the relative value of currencies in a free-floating world market. We're going to eliminate the capitalist system, as Roosevelt did, as Lincoln did, because in any sane modern economy, 50% of the total physical economy and the related activity belongs to basic economic infrastructure, not the production of goods. That is not the production of market goods. 50% of any economy has to be basic economic infrastructure by national governments or state governments or local governments. Some of this can be fudged off into the private sector in the sense of investment in bonds, which are secured in regulated public utilities. But 50% of the economy of the world has to be in the area of basic economic infrastructure, not the so-called market economy. So the market economy, so-called, will be no more than half of the world economy and will be level off at no more than half of the internal economy of any nation. And it will be a regulated economy in which prices are not set by floating free trade arrangement, but prices are set by regulation which is intended to protect necessary investment, capital investment in industry. For example, if you want to have any kind of industry, you must determine the price of the goods of that industry, cover the total cost of that industry, including the labor force, so forth, the taxes which have to be paid out of the labor force, the capital investment necessary to maintain and improve the industry. These things must be the way in which we determine the minimal price of goods which are actually produced in the private sector. So therefore, the private sector will now be regulated by going back to a system of regulation of the type that was canceled under the Carter administration and after, under the influence of the Trilateral Commission. So these are the things we're going to do. Is we are crafting an economy for the future of this planet for the coming 50 years. We're using a commitment to that as the proposition which can interfere with what is now onrushing as a general breakdown crisis of the world. The reason that nations will do what I've indicated now is only because there is no alternative and because they recognize there is no alternative. There's no way the present free trade system can continue except by plunging the entire planet into a new dark age, which the population levels drop rather rapidly toward a leveling off at about feudal age levels of about a half billion to three-quarters of a billion people. Most languages that are spoken in the world today will disappear. Our national cultures will disappear. And therefore, governments and nations and peoples will accept something like this if it's presented to them competently by leadership, because they have no other option. It's that simple. And that often happens in history. You come to a point of crisis where changes are made, where either you make those changes or you go to hell. That's the way it'll work.
Hello, Lynn?
Yeah.
Okay. Hi, this is Hector from the Los Angeles office.
Yeah.
I just wanted to know, because yesterday I read in a report that the Chinese are no longer pegged to the dollar, and as well as Malaysia has bailed out. I was just wondering if that would encourage other countries to do the same, and exactly what would be the outcome of that? Like, will the United States react to that in any form, or any other country? Or I just kind of want to see what you say on that.
Okay. Well, first of all, don't believe any of the reports of the type you're reflecting in your remarks. There is no such thing happened. Under tremendous pressure from the United States government, China made a compromise to establish a float of the value of its currency within a bracket, within a range, a fairly small range. In other words, the Chinese currency is not a free-floating currency. So it's not been allowed to float. It's been allowed to adjust, an adjusting float, within a certain bracket, which will be very tightly managed by the Chinese government. Most of the things you've heard about this from the press, forget. Most of the reports you've heard, forget. Now, what you're faced with is the following situation. If the Chinese currency were to collapse, the United States would collapse immediately. So you don't want a soaring increase of the value of the Chinese currency, nor do you want a collapse of the value of the Chinese currency, either one. You want the currency, the reserves of China, of South Korea and Japan, for example, to remain at about their present levels. Some margin for fluctuation is allowable. The margin will have to be determined by governments, because the fluctuations will have to occur in the overall picture. It will not be a uniform adjustment, commodity by commodity. It will have to be an adjustment on a selective basis. And therefore, the net effect will be that there will be a slight degree of float within a regulated interval, in which the float will be reflected in an average change in price, not a uniform standard across the board change in price. So there'd be an adjustment. Now, if the U.S. system were to collapse, or the Chinese currency were to collapse, or Japanese currency, or South Korean currency, you'd have an immediate collapse of the dollar. You'd have an immediate collapse of Europe. You would have a dark age over this planet if you had that kind of system. So if anything like that were to happen, forget it, boy. Get off the planet. It's coming down. So don't believe what you hear. And don't try to ask yourself or ask others or answer questions where somebody assumes that what happened in the Chinese currency is what was reported as the snow job, that is, the Treasury Secretary Snow, who does snow jobs for Bush and the Vice President, or the President of Vice. So don't believe any of it. It's all garbage. It's misinformation. So don't try to answer the question or interpret the question that's posed to you, because the question itself is a fraud. There was no free float of the Chinese currency. There was no general devaluation or revaluation or anything of the currency. There was an agreement under tremendous U.S. pressure from the snow job administration, the Bush-Cheney administration. There was tremendous pressure for Chinese to concede, to have some flexibility in the value of the currency, the exchange rate of the currency. And that was a U.S.-pressed, U.S.-demanded concession. And if they don't tell you that, tell them they're full of you-know-what, because it's not the Chinese decided. The Chinese didn't decide. They decided to accept a negotiated demand pressed upon them by the United States government.
Hello, Lynn. This is Aaron Sardina from Los Angeles. And my question is based on some of the stuff that you wrote about in Mozart's Musical Revolution. In terms of musical memory and the relationship that it has to the historical development of the nation state, especially with the principle of the American Revolution as being some sort of like intervallic transition in the composition of the human organizational process as a whole, and the effect of those principles within the social field for increasing our potential for the betterment of humanity as a whole on this planet today. How do we look at that?
Well, the problem you have in dealing with that is the fact that the educational system and the cultural assumptions in existing culture are insane. And therefore, people try to interpret things from that standpoint. Now, I dealt with this significantly in the paper on Vygotsky and the Dirichlet's principle. I've dealt with it again in the context of this paper on the vice president's mass insanity. That the problem is people think in terms of a Cartesian model of almost everything. Psychology, politics, economy, physical science, everything is Cartesian. But the world is not Cartesian. Descartes was clinically insane. That is, his system was clinically insane. He was corrupt, but the system was his system was insane. The system was based on the assumption of that the universe is mechanical, that you have pairwise reactions among entities or objects, and these pairwise reactions, action at a distance, pairwise reactions, define everything, that you can reduce everything to the simple kind of mathematics taught in schools. In music, you get a very specific effect of that. For example, people have a great problem in trying to perform simple pieces of counterpoint that is simple in terms of their overall physical requirements, such as the Bach Jesu meine Freude. Almost no one, very few people among us, even the youth, have yet understood exactly how that works. They're learning. The Boston group is doing the best because they have the best instructions and because they have a higher concentration of musical talent. That is, people who have professional types of musical capabilities among the youth there. And so that's a very important factor. In other parts of the country, we have a much weaker situation because people do not know, number one, they really have not caught up to speed on the question of the Florentine bel canto voice training. It's set at 256C approximately. That's necessary. And if you don't have that, you don't understand music. If you go from that, you're going to have an impairment of any interpretation of music. If you don't understand the Bach well-tempered system, as based on the Florentine bel canto voice training program, then you don't really understand music. Because what happens is you have two aspects, say, to a simplest aspect of a musical composition. You have what most people look at is they look at the score, and they read the vertical chord-like determination of intervals. And they will look at also at a pairwise note-to-note relationship. They will compare these pairwise note-to-note relationships in terms of a vertical structure of, say, a choral work, which means they really don't understand what the whole thing's about. What John Sigerson, for example, is doing in, shall we say, tuning or getting the retuning of the choral groups on things like Jesu meine Freude, in which important discoveries are being made regularly by members, for example, of the Boston group, just by their experiment. They're seeing things. Oh, hey, look, that sort of thing. And John is emphasizing that as acting as a choral director with knowledge of exactly what you have to do in adjusting in the so-called cross-voice relationship, where you have two kinds of cross-voice relationship, which requires understanding and training in the bel canto voice training system. Because you have register shifts, and when you go across a register shift, you have an effect, which you have to take into account in understanding how things work. Because you can have what seem to be the same notes, but if they're sung by a baritone, the register shift is located differently than for a tenor or for a soprano or alto. So which voice is doing what is extremely important, simply in terms of what the significance of register shifts. Then also, when you the object of a musical composition, and take the vocal type, which is simple, like, sure, take very the relatively simplest case, the motet ab verum corpus, a very simple motet, which contains a lot of things on the Lydian mode. Now, what you have to do in music, for example, and this pertains to everything else, and it's so classical musical composition as opposed to this crazy brand X variety you hear nowadays most of the time, is actually a part of the way in which we communicate ideas. It's a exemplar of the way the mind should be organized. That if you organize around rock music, your mind is not well organized. You got a little tilt there in the system. If your mind is organized in a way that corresponds to a informed bel canto, informed performance, say, of the Mozart Ave Verum Corpus, and it conforms to a certain standard, then you know your mind is working fairly well. If it doesn't do that, then there's something wrong with the way your mind is working on everything. Now, what's the point here, to go from music to the everything? Function of music, of classical composition, as typified by actually the Bach Jesu meine Freude and by the Ave Verum Corpus. Take the Ave Verum Corpus, which is a simpler thing to get at, because we've written a lot about it. Mindy Pechnuk did a study of this thing, which we worked on, and we have some tapes on that, on the actual demonstration of it from a conference. I take that. Now, the idea of a musical composition, a classical musical composition, is to come, you start with a moment of silence. In other words, you don't start singing in the middle of a crowd. You may do that under certain circumstances, but you don't learn how to do it under those circumstances. You go outside. You get an area which is acoustically functional. And that's very important. You just can't do it any place. You can't do it in any studio. It is not going to be effective. You have to find a place which is acoustically sound for music. Now, you go in there, and you get yourself warmed up, first of all. The first thing that singers do is they do warm-ups. They do the bel canto warm-ups, the Florentine bel canto warm-ups. And they go through that voice by voice, all the way through. They get the whole set ensemble, the chorus, tuned in that way. Before you start anything. Otherwise, you don't start. You're going to make a mess of it. Even experienced singers, if they don't do warm-ups, they were going to tend to make a mess of then performing anything. And it has to be bel canto, Florentine bel canto warm-ups, not some other brand X variety. Then, what do you start with? What does every good performance start with? It starts with a moment of absolute silence. Dead silence, or as near to that without coughs in the audience as possible. And once the director of the chorus figures the coughs are behind us, and he has a breath which is not interrupted by coughs or other distractions, then he raises his eyebrows and his eyes and looks at the chorus. And they begin to sing under his direction. And then you come to the completion of the performance. The last note is sounded. And there's another moment of silence. Absolute silence. There should be no sudden applause that destroys everything, if you get that. A respectful audience which has paid attention to a good performance will not start applauding at the moment of the last note is sounding. Never do that. That's rude, and that's boorish, and that's naughty. Wait a moment, and then decide if you're going to applaud. Because you have to have a moment of reflection before you start applauding. Be sure, don't be an impulse buyer. See what you're getting before you buy it. And that impulse should be a matter of buying something. Don't buy it until you know what you bought. And a moment of silence is required to reflect on just that question. It may come instinctively, but it has to come that way. Now, what's the standard, therefore, of the composition and performance of a classical composition of a choral type of these types, say the Ave Verum Corpus, there must be not in the just the sounds heard, but in the mind's hearing. That is, the hearing of the music in the mind, not in the ears as such. There must be, and it must be the whole chorus, not a voice at a time. The whole chorus. Oh, this was, she sang beautifully. That is irrelevant. That may, you may comment on that later in discussing the entire performance. But to try to pick out somebody and characterize the whole composition by the way one person in the chorus sang, that's nonsense. That's not music. That's not social. That's masturbation. Yeah? So what's the standard? The standard is that in the mind, as the music, effect of the music is heard in the mind, there is an unbroken continuity of a sense of development, a sense of necessity from the beginning, the first breath of silence, to the last breath of silence, according to the Dirichlet principle. So the composition as a whole is not something you can discuss piecemeal, though you can make that kind of discussion, but the discussion of the composition and performance as a whole cannot be piecemeal. It has to be a sense of an indivisible unit of activity, from breath of silence at the opening to breath of silence at the end, which defines, according to a Dirichlet principle, the composition and its performance as a whole as an object. Now, the object here, with the point is which goes beyond music into your larger aspect of your question, is all subjects are like that. And what I've just described for the sense of choral performance, which is what most musicians don't understand, especially nowadays, is they don't understand Dirichlet's principle, of course, but they also don't understand what goes into defining a great classical musical composition as such as the simple Ave Verum Corpus of Mozart as a case of Dirichlet's principle. They don't understand that. Why? Because they do approach this in a Cartesian note-by-note fashion. And nothing in the universe is Cartesian. It is all. It is all a question of dynamics. As dynamics are defined by the ancient Greeks, the Pythagoreans and Plato, and defined by Leibniz, among others. So therefore, that's the problem. The problem is to stop thinking in terms of pairwise interaction of objects and persons into the complex interaction of many persons in a social practice around a mission. And the interaction between the totality of the participants and the role of the individual within the joint action of the participants. You know, this is a dynamic system, not a mechanical system. And the problem in society is the Cartesian method is a method of thinking mechanically about everything, including social processes. That's where the problem lies.
Lynn, can you take a couple more questions?
Why, sure.
Okay. Hello, I'm a new member. My name is Brent. I'm from the Los Angeles office. I'd like to talk about ellipses. I have a question about ellipses. I know how to construct an ellipse with a string and two fixed points. I also know how to slice a cone to create an ellipse by slicing between its perpendicular axes. Mm-hmm. And I'm also familiar with the elliptical motion of planets. Each of these processes generate the ellipse. I also already know that when you have A representing the semi-major axis, B representing the semi-minor axis, that points on an ellipse can be modeled by an equation, you know, x squared over a squared plus y squared over b squared equals 1. I've been trying to work with this equation, maybe in a top-down system, but trying to see how this is contained in the ellipse. It doesn't seem to come intuitively from any of those processes, whether generated from string, planet, or cone. I was wondering if you could help me put the ellipse into historical context, mm-hmm. all the discoveries of these three distinct modes of generation.
Well, the problem is
how that idea known to man translates into that equation. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's, again, the same problem I just addressed, the question of the a dynamic as opposed to a mechanical conception. What you've described in terms of these equations is a mechanical interpretation of the ellipse, which is not a scientific one. The actual defining of the ellipse, which was done by, in that sense, in modern times, by Kepler, was not based on those constructions. Those constructions, those mathematical constructions, were based on the assumption which had of a principle which had already been established by Kepler. How? The key thing here is a constant change in the motion itself. In other words, when you try to say, I can draw a map by algebraic methods, I can draw a map of a construction which conforms to an ellipse, that is not the way the elliptical orbit functions. So the question here, the error is, the problem you're getting into, is the distinction between a mechanical construction of a pathway, which happens to be a pathway more or less coinciding with the apparent fixed recurring pathway of an orbit, planetary orbit, and the actual generation of that orbit. So what Kepler was looking at was the generation of the orbit, not the pathway of the orbit. The pathway of the orbit was considered by looking at the generation of that orbital pathway by a planet. Now, the point is the planet's motion is constantly changing. And it's constantly changing such that in the most infinitesimal interval, the direction of motion is changing. That is, the velocity of the motion is changing at every infinitesimal instant of that operation. So therefore, what we're talking about elliptical functions, we are not talking about how to draw an ellipse. And the so-called Cartesian or quasi-Cartesian constructions of the ellipse do not tell us how the planetary elliptical orbits are generated, nor any other elliptical orbits or pathways in physical science. So the problem is when you go to abstract or Cartesian or axiomatic kinds of mathematics per se, rather than physical reality, you get into a problem. There is in no case is a dead man who just died a living man. And when we talk about biology, human biology, we're talking about living processes, not dead ones. You want to describe a dead man and tell except as the decay begins to set in. The dead man can be described. But you can't get a living man out of that description. And that's true of all living processes, for example. It's true of the universe. So the problem here, the common problem, is the classroom problem of saying that you can, from a Cartesian standpoint, the standpoint of Euler or Lagrange or Cauchy, that from that standpoint, can you describe an orbit? Yes. Is it the physical orbit of the planet? No. So therefore, you're using the wrong measurement. The measurement which is for one purpose, you're using it for a completely different one, which doesn't it conform to. So the thing you need to discuss is especially at the apparent loop, which is what was crucial for Kepler, look at the apparent loop in the orbit of Mars, which is an elliptical orbit, as observed from a non-normalized observation of that motion. And that is what defines the elliptical orbit, which is not the blackboard ellipse.
Hey, Lynn, this is Nick Walsh.
Aha. You're back there, huh?
Yeah. I've been here for a few months, I think. It's about March. I wanted to get back to what you're bringing up in the Pericles memo paper and what you remarked about in the opening statement.
Yeah.
This thing you were bringing, your role in the FDI and how that impacts what we're doing now. Mm-hmm. And especially with this thing you're bringing up in this paper about the nature of the Constitution, how it has a quality of, it's the same as kind of a physical scientific body of knowledge, that it's
It's always being added upon and developed by the next, let's say, generation of leadership or whatever. I mean, specifically, you have this one quote that says, now, I haven't gotten the newest edition, but I think this is probably still in there. It says, our Constitution, taken as a whole, does provide, at least implicitly, optional remedies for the cases of both President Bush and Vice President Cheney as such, a choice of remedies which could apparently leave the intent of the Constitution superficially intact, such as relieve Cheney of his office first. I mean, it's kind of perplexing to me, this thing about how, just I'd like you to elaborate more, how do we, this question of, first of all, specifically this question of, you say, superficially intact, like what do you mean by that?
Okay, good.
But how does this role of introducing new principles and developing the Constitution, it's very, I don't know if you know what I'm asking. It's not.
I know exactly what you're asking. Very clear. All right, this is a variant on the, you know, a much simpler question which was asked on the question of ellipses. Huh? This is one of the reasons that I've used Vernadsky so liberally to try to get people to understand what science is and what law is, real law. Now, look at the conception of Vernadskyan conception of the universe. You have three different phase spaces which are interacting. One is the what we call the abiotic, the other the biosphere, the third the noosphere. And they are superior to one another in terms of power, long-term power, in determining the universe in that order. That is, the abiotic is the weakest part of the universe, is the abiotic. The living part of the universe is more powerful than the non-living. The cognitive part of the universe, which is known through man, is more powerful than the living processes, which is ironical because the abiotic is generally the more immediate determinant of the characteristics of the process as a whole, but the biological is more determining than the abiotic in the long term, as the character of the Earth in terms of its fossil development occurs. Then you have that even though the cognition has a less effect, immediate effect in the short term, on the biosphere than living processes as such, in the longer term, the cognitive process of creative development in human ideas have a more permanent, cumulatively greater power over the Earth than does the living process as such. Now, the way we define this is we don't go out and say there's this object which is the non-living object, and there's this object which is the living object, and there's this object which is the cognitive object. We look at it from a different standpoint. The phenomena we use experimentally, remember the question is the experimental method. We set up a test. We say, assuming that there is no such thing as life, only the things which we observe as being non-living processes, we study those, and we find anything that conforms to that, we call the non-living or abiotic domain. But then we find that there are changes in the abiotic domain, as the fossil case demonstrates this. In other words, the fact is the Earth got an atmosphere from life, not from abiotic process. The Earth got water and oceans from life, not from an abiotic process. That, as Vernadsky describes it on this chemical thing in 1935-36, that what happens is that all the things we're looking at that we call fossils of life occur by what appears to be a simple chemistry. The materials of the abiotic domain are absorbed by living processes, which kick these things around, so to speak, and eject them as sort of like defecating on the abiotic, leaving behind fossils which are different chemically, both in their distribution and in their characteristics, than you would otherwise find among non-living processes. So therefore, we recognize, therefore, by negation, experimental negation in biology, we recognize that there is a principle of life which we are not measuring. We are not measuring the principle of life. We're measuring the effect of the principle of life. And we define the principle of life not as an object which is seen with the senses, but as an effect on something that can be seen with the senses, so to speak, and measured. The same thing comes in the question of the noosphere, in the question of the noetic. We find processes which cannot be done by living processes other than man, other than the mind of man, other than by the effects of the process of discovery of universal physical principles by mankind. And this, in this case, we do the same thing. We, as human beings, cognitive processes, we take the both the abiotic and the biotic domain of objects, so-called object processes, and we see that there's a transformation which has occurred in these processes, these inferior processes, which now dump things back on them, which occur only as a result of the intervention of human cognitive activity, which produces a noosphere, which is more powerful in terms of its cumulative effect than the biosphere or the abiotic domain. Again, so therefore the principle of human life, as distinct from animal life, is reflected negatively in the fact that we cannot directly account for cognition in terms of biology. In all living species other than man, cognition does not occur. Only the effects of cognition. Therefore, just as life is not defined by the abiotic processes, experimental view of living biological systems, so human life is not defined by animal life, the methods of exalting animal life. Now, what happens is, as I said in this paper, is that what you have is with the birth of an appropriate type of living processes, the birth or the conception of a new individual, a human individual, in the form of a fetus. That fetus is not like a monkey fetus, though in the case of Bush you may raise some questions on this issue. Yeah? But I don't think Barbara is really responsible in that sense biologically for her son's failures, subhuman failures. So therefore we know that there is a power of creativity which acts, and we don't know when this acts or how this acts exactly, but we know that, for example, a six-month fetus, which is comes ahead, you know, way born ahead of term, delivered ahead of term, if it survives, becomes a normal, usually a normal adult person with all the cognitive and other capabilities of a normal adult person. So the question is, when does this fetus become human in this form that we know of an adult or a child, a born child, an adult? So we don't. We'd simply say that this thing, at some point in the process of gestation, from conception into gestation, the appropriateness of this particular kind of living processes for the cognition, to be infected by the potential of cognition, cuts in and takes over. And it produces effects which are tangible, biological effects and other effects, which show that cognition, a principle of cognition, which we cannot define biologically or medically, nonetheless produces an effect which can be seen biologically and medically in terms of the effect of the discovery, the process of discovery of a valid experimental principle, which is a creative discovery, which changes the universe and causes the effect we call the noosphere. So there, that is the question of method here. Now, in the case of the Constitution, when we're talking about natural law, the most advantageous way to look at it today, because of the effects of Vinansky's work and so forth, because of things going into that, it is easier to make clear what we're talking about in terms of natural law generally by aid of using the Vinansky case, as we've discussed it. Because what we're saying is that it is not the literal Constitution which is the law. The Constitution is a reflection of the law in the same way that a living biological process is a reflection of the principle of life. And the way, and as the cognition or the noosphere is a reflection of the activity and the lawful activity specific to human creativity. That is the actual creative principle, or the principle of hypothesis. So therefore, we say, to understand the Constitution as law, we must go to the higher level where the Constitution is generated and define the principles of generation of the Constitution as its law, rather than interpreting the after the fact effect of the words which are written. So therefore, that's why I say the question of immortality. Man is immortal because when you die, biologically, you don't die, not cognitively. All the great discoveries of physical principle and similar things, which are transmitted from one person to society and generations to come, live on. And the only way, as you know, from the work of the youth movement and education, particularly starting from the Gauss thing, where we started this educational program for the limb, all has been concentrated upon this principle of demonstrating this principle, starting with Gauss's attack on D'Alembert, Euler, and Lagrange. Or you could add Cauchy, of course, in there as another scoundrel. So when you look at it from that standpoint, now you see there's a constitution of creativity in science. That the constitution has the form and effect which is framed within a dynamic, as the Pythagoreans and Plato defined dynamic, or dynamis, as Leibniz does, not any other way. So therefore, when we talk about law and natural law, we have to talk about the generation of natural law, in the sense of natural law is distinct from written law, as human genius is distinct from biological organizations, and as life is distinct from biological organizations. So that's the point. You have the location, as I keep insisting on this question of immortality, the experimental nature of the immortality of man, of the individual, within the human species as a process, as a dynamic process, defines the individual person as immortal, because what makes them human, which is expressed as the discovery of a universal physical principle, for example, is something that lives on with their identity ever after, as it is replicated, as the discovery is replicated in the same way in the mind of somebody else. And I keep referring, of course, to the case of this prolific Mr. Archimedes, who was not perfect by any means, as Kuza pointed out, as an example of that. That the discoveries which are made by the ancient Egyptians live on in classical Greek culture, the Pythagoreans and Plato, and so forth. And so it is with us. We do not die unless we deserve to die, because we repudiate our creative potential. As long as we are living and participating in the transmission and development of these ideas, which are ideas of principle, we are alive. We are immortal. And the minute we stop doing that, we cease to be immortal, and we go to hell, which is called the rubbish bin of people who repudiated the peculiarity of humanity. And therefore, natural law starts from the standpoint of the human being's creativity, the creative powers of the human being, and how these creative powers, by their interaction with the universe and among people, is dynamic, not mechanical. And once we understand that, the purpose of society is not to use creativity to assist a process. Creativity is the process. That's the difference.
Lynn, can you take one or two more?
One.
One more.
I got a meeting coming up.
Okay, we appreciate the time. We have one more question then.
Hello.
I've been a member
I can't hear
almost
you.
2 years, and I'm going to speak slow so you can understand me. Now, what was that? Okay. Now, I was listening to what you were saying in your speech earlier, that we, the youth, we represent humanity for the next couple of generations, that we are to lead this population back to a recovery civilization. Now, I'm not afraid to admit that when I go out and organize every single day, that I'm completely scared shitless, because we have a population that's in a sense that, you know, they have been demoralized to the fact that they do not see themselves as a human individual, that they are willing to go out and accept themselves as being a slave. Now, it's kind of fucked up, because it just shows how bad the population is, what if they're willing to accept themselves as a slave. But my question is, how do we go at it and to organize in this population to think on a higher level, because we are the generation that are going to mold the population to think that way. And what I mostly do is I organize the population around these historical leaders like King, like Joan of Arc and others, you know, around the sublime. But a lot of the population say that, you know, the only way we can actually do something is that if we were to have another tragedy. I'm like, well, evidently you don't know what a tragedy is, because if you got a guy who's riding on a bicycle running over people, that's a tragedy. That's our president. That's a tragedy. But I'm saying, what should we be doing? How can we actually get the level to think on, you know, on a higher level, on higher principles?
Well, first of all, you already are doing it. But you've got to watch where your emphasis lies. If your emphasis lies on the idea of Martin Luther King or Jeanne d'Arc, that's not bad. But that is not getting to the core of the matter. Getting to the core of the matter is looking at history, the way these fellows not were just heroes in the situation, but how their minds functioned, which were different than the way other minds around them functioned. Look, for example, to understand King, as you have to look at Jeanne d'Arc, you have to look at the people around them. Now, what happened when they died, when they were killed? Jeanne d'Arc's action, and it was an action which is based on her refusal to compromise, knowing that she would be burned alive if she didn't compromise. That was the action which inspired what became possible as the first modern nation state, a revolution in society. Martin Luther King, when he died, nothing much happened. We had a result of his work, but there was no one who appeared to carry on. As in the case of Jeanne d'Arc, others carried on. But nobody really carried on. There were people who carried on to defend his accomplishments and to try to build on his accomplishments, his influence, and so forth. But there was no new Martin Luther King. No, none. I've gone through this, but I know there were none. I have studied the leadership of the top leadership around King, and there was no one who had this distinctive quality that made Martin Luther King, Martin Luther King, at the time he died. There were people, many people, who were part of a movement of which Jeanne d'Arc reflected, actually in that time. There were many people, including, for example, the case of Jeanne d'Arc was, after her killing, was brought up in the councils, the Vatican, or the councils of the papacy, in Italy, in the period following her murder, her judicial murder by the British Inquisition, the Norman Inquisition. And her case, even though the Pope in question died very soon after that, but her case became a cause celebre in the Renaissance, in the 15th century Renaissance. It was also a cause celebre in circles in France, which were influenced by what she did. As a matter of fact, shortly after her death, there was a mobilization of French patriots, contrary to the poor, foolish prince and king who had betrayed her. And they beat the Normans and kicked them out of France somewhat and laid the basis for what became the French Renaissance under Louis Onze. So, therefore, there was a continuity. So our problem here, which is the problem I face in particular, the problem I face is, what happens if I die? Who is there going to be? Am I going to be another Martin Luther King, in the sense that when I die, the the good that I've done may linger about and benefit people, as King's good, of course, did benefit greatly a lot of people, and not just people of so-called African-American designation. Am I going to be in the same kind of situation with virtually no one to pick up and play the role that I play? That's the question. Huh? So the important thing for you to understand and to orient in how you deal with this thing you're dealing with, to get your confidence in shape, is to recognize that in the course of humanity's histories to date, that 95% or 99% or more of the population ain't worth shucks when it comes to providing actual leadership for a time of crisis. They depend upon a limited number of human beings who emerge as qualified leaders who are on the scene and in a position of influence at the time the necessary crucial action occurs or is ready to occur. Our concern is to orient the population, first of all, to the role of such exceptional people in science and other fields who are the actual leaders who enable culture to progress and develop, and to have the idea of that, and to have people look for that kind of leadership, to demand that kind of leadership or an approximation of it from the people they serve. Don't say, which guy am I going to vote for? Who are you going to select who is qualified to be voted for? How do you take the dummy, in a sense, who is a candidate or who's an incumbent official, and take this guy who's acting like a dummy? He may not be a dummy, but he's acting like one in many respects. How do you get him to see his or her own potential for leadership? And therefore, the population, just like a child looking at a parent, looking at an older sibling, is looking for leadership. Because society is based on leadership. What has happened to this society is that the result of the Congress for Cultural Freedom, under the doctrine of the so-called authoritarian personality, that the bastards who have ruined this country and ruined the world have said that leadership is sick, that the idea of leadership is the idea of the authoritarian personality. You must get rid of that. You must have a frictional basis where people rub bellies against each other, and somehow all the heat of rubbing bellies, sexually and otherwise, you sometimes get the heat that makes things work mechanically. And the problem here is that the population has been conditioned against the idea of leadership, against the idea of Franklin Roosevelt, the attacks on Franklin Roosevelt, making jokes about Franklin Roosevelt, popular stunt, shows that people have become decadent, even degenerate. Because without Roosevelt, we wouldn't be here. We'd be living in a fascist dictatorship already, on the way toward it now. So therefore, the point is how do you deal with people? You have to deal with people realistically. For example, I have a problem now with the African-American constituency. Because recently, as a result of demoralization, people who were once leaders of the African-American strata have failed. They've dropped out. They've gone into pursuit of money for faith-based initiative money. As a result, you have the people in the ghettos, as in the terrible Baltimore ghetto up here in Maryland. You have these people, they live a hopeless existence that's worsening every moment. Everything becomes bad. They want some money. You have the Baltimore prison, 40% with HIV infected. What do you see politically? You see nothing politically. They're demoralized because their leaders have betrayed them. They betrayed them because they were betrayed. Because the Democratic Party betrayed them. And they go to the Republican Party. And they make jokes against Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt. It's crazy. And therefore, the problem here is, why are the people in these ghettos who are being destroyed, why don't they fight? Except in some form of some crazy kind of thing. Why don't they organize politically to defend themselves, to act as citizens and assert their authority in society? Why do they take drugs? Why do they allow this? Why do they allow this situation? Because they don't have a sense of any leadership. This is true throughout society. You have an optimistic area, like the machine tool people in General Motors and Ford. They have optimism because they have optimism in their bones because of what they do. They give courage to other people around them. because they know how to do things. And people around them know that. The thousands of people who work in a factory, in an auto factory, a related factory, exist because that machine tool guy, who probably is a UAW leader, is there to do the things that give them the jobs they need to live, to support their families and their community. So the problem here is a sense of, to get a sense across of what leadership really means. It means essentially that so forth and so far in history, that a very small percentile of the total population are actually leaders. Leaders intellectually, in the sense of science or artistic work. Leaders in the sense of politics. Leaders in other related senses. Very few leaders. Very few great educators, and so forth. So therefore, the mass of the population is sitting down there, not knowing, not having the impulse within them to give leadership. They're looking for leadership. They're willing to support leadership. We have to get across this conception of leadership and get the sense of connecting them to leadership. What we have right now before us, which is a new condition we've developed essentially since the beginning of the election campaign, the 2004 election campaign in 2003, and even before, back to 2000, right after the defeat, essentially, which elected or didn't elect George Bush the first time. Since that time, we've been working. We've produced a change in the country. By my running a presidential campaign the way I did, even over the opposition of many people in my own organization who resisted me, particularly, they didn't want me to go to Boston the way I went. Go, no, we don't have the money, We got to be reasonable, don't do it. Well, I did it. And as a result of what we did, and as a result of what we did before then in running the campaign, we made a breakthrough as a cumulative effect of our campaign, my campaign for the presidency. That breakthrough brought us into agreement with a certain part of the leadership of the Democratic Party at circles around President Clinton and others. That, in the end of August, beginning of September, that fact that we were working on the inside of the Democratic Party gave us an acceptance of me, which was grudging, but it was there, because they knew I was needed to help fight the campaign for the election of Kerry against Bush. It was too late. Kerry wasn't prepared fully for what he had to do, and the opposition was nasty. So we lost. But then, after the apparent defeat, which was actually a stolen election in various ways, after the defeat, I got on the horn. I was now in the party. I was now recognized as an accepted, significant, however begrudgingly, part of the party operation, and a needed part in this particular situation. So from about November 7th of last year on, we have had an increasing influence. We have played a complete part. We don't want to take too much credit for it, but we played a decisive role. I played personally a decisive role in tilting the situation so that the attempted coup d'etat by Cheney in the Congress, in the Senate, was defeated on May 23rd. Now, I can't take credit for what happened, but I was the catalytic factor without which that wouldn't have happened. And therefore, that's the situation. So you have to give to people a sense of leadership. And the only way you can do that is in the sense of our leadership. Because my leadership is based on the fact that you exist. I will die within 10 years or so. You will live. You will live as a key factor in this society for two generations to come. My existence is effective because you exist and do what you're doing. All you have to do is just be conscious of that, that you are becoming my replacement. But you have to learn what I did and what I do, and learn it well. Learn it better than I did, because you have the advantage of knowing how I did it. And you can do better than I did, or at least some of you will. And others will help that process. That's what you have. That's the lesson to learn.
All right, Lynn, thank you very much.
Thank you. See you all soon.
So we are going to take a